Section 8. Weighing the Evidence. The Gospels generally afford us no evidence whatever for discerning a historical Jesus. Because of their extensive use of fabrication and literary invention, and their placing of other goals far ahead of what we regard as historical truth, we cannot know if anything in them has any historical basis, except what we can verify externally, which for Jesus is next to nothing. They are simply myths about Jesus and the gospel. They are not seriously researched biographies or historical accounts, and are certainly not eyewitness testimonies or even collected hearsay. Their literary art and structure are simply too sophisticated for that. This is equally expected on both minimal historicity and minimal mythicism, however, and therefore, apart from what we've already accounted for in determining the prior probability in Chapter 6, the Gospels have no effect on the probability that Jesus existed, neither to raise or lower it. A more ardent skeptic could disagree. Here I am arguing a fortiori, and as such granting historicity its best shot. But some will still ask why the Gospels appear out of nowhere, 40 to 80 years after the fact, as fully structured literary myths, rather than their first being more mundane reports, memoirs, and accounts, closer to the events concerned, only later evolving into increasingly grandiose myths. Like the example of Haile Selassie in Chapter 2, we have abundant mundane records of the man, and then later appear the sacred myths. Why is this not the case for Jesus? On background evidence, we can perhaps expect the why of it is that the church had no motive to preserve any of that earlier stuff. I have already discussed that possibility well enough in Chapter 8. The matter logically belongs there, although a related matter is why there aren't such details even in the epistles, as we'll see in the next chapter. Here we are concerned only with the content of the Gospels by themselves, and as such, even as completely fabricated myths, they could be such for a historical man or a cosmic one. From the material examined here, I see neither as inherently more likely. We have to look elsewhere for evidence. A more ardent apologist might disagree in the other direction and ask how it is the cosmic myths became earthly myths. Isn't a historical Jesus, in fact, more mundane and thus a shift in an unexpected direction? More mundane, yes, but unexpected, no. That very trend to euhemerize and thus make more mundane the tales of cosmic gods was actually typical, element 45. Indeed, to serve their obvious function as models for missionary life, values, and teaching, not only must Jesus' story be transformed to resemble the earthly experience of missionaries by having him interact with the world and society they live in, but a gospel's text also becomes considerably more powerful and effective if it is also taken literally. As I said before in Chapter 8, because it's harder to believe you should follow a fictional model, whereas if you believe Jesus really did and said these things, then you have a much stronger impetus to be awed by that and strive to follow his example. Such historicizing also gave church hierarchies more control over doctrine and a rhetorical advantage over competitors, and thus it is more likely to be an observed feature of the eventually prevailing sect. As noted in Chapter 8, this gave church hierarchies more control over doctrine because they could then claim to have it from an unbroken line of tradents, in a set of documents and claims they themselves controlled, so no one could bypass their authority by continuing to receive updated revelations from Jesus or his angels. Paul was already trying to battle this problem in Galatians 1. The Montanist sect would represent the last vestige of that Pauline model of establishing authority, and that was stamped out by more successful sects, who, to win such debates, invented a canon and a tradition history, which once established could not as easily be changed. And so those in power got to pick their successors from then on, the ultimate dream of every oligarchy. We already saw that this was a routine trend all across ancient religion in Element 44. The result is that the later Gospels, Luke and John, began explicitly selling themselves as historical truth, even while they continued composing in the same fictional symbolic way, evidently in a nod to the more enlightened Christians, as well as in a bid to market to everyone the ideas those stories symbolized, this time in a package more ardently sold as historically true. While the other Gospels, Mark and Matthew, also began to be sold as such, even if they did not so obviously sell themselves that way at first. Possibly, higher-ranking insiders were let in on the truth, but the majority could not be, for fear they couldn't handle it, and thus would reject the gospel and not be saved. This elitist disdain for the lower ranks of the membership is reflected in later Christian literature, where we saw that this doctrine of double meaning, one the symbolic and allegorical for the elite, and the other the literal for the hoi polloi, had certainly become standard in the church by the end of the second century, which necessitated keeping the purely esoteric meaning as far from public knowledge as reasonably possible. There is no reason to believe this two-tiered system of knowledge did not already exist from the very beginning. In fact, Paul attests to such a system already existing in his churches, and it appears to have existed even before he arrived. On all of this again, see Element 13. As I noted earlier, this should have consequences to future research on the Gospels. Indeed, we need to shift entirely to asking the question, what is the author attempting to say or accomplish with this story, or with his revision of this story? And not ask, did that actually happen? Because the latter simply wasn't a concern of these authors. Even if they were concerned to convince people it happened, they were not themselves concerned if it actually did. They had a different agenda, and are crafting the myths they need to sell it. The Gospels were produced by faith communities for preaching, teaching, and propaganda, and not as disinterested or even interested biographical inquiry. There is no indication in them of a quest to determine what Jesus really said or did. There is no discussion of sources or of reasons to prefer one claim to another, or of attempts to interpret contradictory data, or even any mention of the existence of real alternative accounts, even though we know they knew of them, because they all covertly used them as source material. Each author just makes Jesus say or do whatever they want. They change the story as suits them and neglect to mention they did so. They craft literary artifices and symbolic narratives routinely. They frequently rewrite classical and biblical stories and just insert Jesus into them. If willing to do all that, and plainly they were, the authors of the Gospels clearly had no interest in any actual historical data. And if they had no interest in that, and plainly they didn't need a historical Jesus. Even if there had been one, he was wholly irrelevant to their aims and designs. These are thus not historians. They are mythographers, novelists, propagandists. They are deliberately inventing what they present in their texts. And they are doing it for a reason, even if we can't always discern what that is. The Gospels simply must be approached as such. We have to stop thinking we can use them as historical sources. The consequence of this to the present query is simple. From the survey in this chapter, it's clear that if we went from pericope to pericope, assessing the likelihood of it being true, rather than invented to communicate a desired point or to fit a pre-planned narrative structure, each time updating our prior probability that anything in the Gospels can be considered reliable evidence for a historical Jesus, then that probability would consistently go down, or level off somewhere low, but never rise. In fact, I have not found a single pericope in these Gospels that is more likely true than false. These Gospels are therefore no different than the dozens of other Gospels that weren't selected for the canon, as I discussed in Element 44. They are all just made-up stories. To change this conclusion, historicists need to find a way to prove that something about the historical Jesus in the Gospels is probably true. Not possibly true, but probably true. They have often attempted this, but so far only with completely invalid methods, as I have already thoroughly documented in Chapter 5 of Proving History. I see no prospect of any valid method ever succeeding at that task. But only time will tell. For now, my conclusion is that we can ascertain nothing in the Gospels that can usefully verify the historicity of Jesus. But neither do they prove he didn't exist. As evidence, they simply make no difference to that equation.